The following is a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Good morning, gentlemen. Good to see you all.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. I guess the big news of the day or this week is inflation sitting at 2.8%. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, that was a little unexpected. The experts, I guess I got to put that in air quotes, had expected it to go up a little bit. Energy prices were up and a few other things. The rent was up over 8% year to year, but other costs were down. And so that offset it more than, and it actually dropped from 2.9 to 2.8. So this is putting a little bit of pressure on the government to say, okay, we may have to lower interest rates, because this is right in the sweet spot. They said anytime between 2 and 3%, and this is 2 months in a row, we will start to look at lowering interest rates, because we have now kind of broke the back of inflation. And this is great news for people that are getting mortgages or renewing. Not yet, because they haven't dropped them yet, but there is a lot of momentum thinking they will. And with that is those first home buyers particularly, and they have also those first-time home buyer savings plans. I know you're going to discuss that a bit, Mitch.
Yeah, and I mean, just to piggyback on what you were saying there, I did read a little bit recently that they do have to play a little bit of a game here, that the interest rates, they have to be really careful about how they lower them, because once people see the inflation come down and the amount they're going to lower interest rates, they're also afraid that they're going to create a huge housing boom.
Yeah.
And prices are already very high and unaffordable in Ontario and many places in Canada. So they do have to be very careful with what they say, how quick they lower interest rates, and really temper expectations. Because if people think that the houses are going to just absolutely explode in price, well, then we're going to be back where we were before. So we do also have to be very careful with lowering interest rates. It is great news, especially for anyone who is stuck in a variable rate mortgage. All those ones during COVID that were locking in, and they're getting into a variable under 2%. Now they're looking at 6-7% mortgage rates, and they've been underwater for a little bit of time here. Well, they're seeing some good news, but they shouldn't get their expectations that the things are going to change extremely quick. And now that we're talking about housing prices and how they should rebound, as the stock market has, I know we've said the housing market takes a little bit of time to go down when the stock market goes down, as well as the housing market takes time to recover a little bit longer than the stock market does. Houses are a little bit more emotional, and they do take some more time to get out of people's hands as well. They're not super liquid as a stock is. But if we're going to talk about the new account here that just came out last year, was the FHSA, the First Home Savings Account. And this is an absolute great account. And I want to keep kind of just coming on this show and talking about it, because lots of people still don't know what it is. They don't know how it works. And frankly, there are a lot of different strategies that people can use this for. Some, even if they're not even going to buy a house. And the government of Canada is probably going to change these rules at some point. But as of right now, there are rules in place that you don't have to buy a house to actually have a first home savings account. But let's just go over the details here a little bit as to what a first home savings account is and what was in place before. So the program before was the RSP home buyers, and this allowed you to use $35,000 of your RSP, your registered retirement savings plan, and you got to take this out tax-free with no penalty to put towards a down payment of a house. And this is a great program. It did have its limitations, though. $35,000 for a down payment in this kind of market for houses really wasn't getting you too far, as much as it used to, at least. That being said, if you did have a spouse, you could both use it and get to $70,000. But the downside of this is that you also had to pay it back. You had one grace year, and then you had 15 years after that. So you basically had to pay this back within 16 years. Otherwise, the amount that you don't pay back continuously gets added to your income for that year. So you do have to pay that RSP homebuyers back. Otherwise, it gets added to your income. And That's obviously going to be taxed at your marginal rate. Now, the First Home Savings Account, this was just released. A lot of institutions were able to implement it in mid or late 2023. And this program really, it allows anyone who is 18 years and older all the way up until age 71. So there is a limit of the age that you can open this to open a First Home Savings Account. And the year that you open it is when your room starts to generate. So the maximum annual contribution is $8,000. And as I said, this starts the year that you open it. So it doesn't start at a certain age. It starts the year you open it. So one thing that I do like to mention to people that even if you're not going to contribute to it, at least open it. It allows you more flexibility down the line, because then once you open it, at least then you have 8,000 room. And then the next year you have 16, and it continues on until you reach the maximum amount of contribution room of $40,000. You can't deduct more than 16 in one given year. So you're not able to do that, but you are able to, over the lifetime of this plan, contribute $40,000. So the way the government worked this account is that it's a combination basically of an RSP and a TFSA. So all of these contributions that you put into this account, they're going to be tax deductible, just as an RSP contribution was. And they're going to grow tax-free, just like an RSP, as well as a TFSA. And so you do get to deduct this from your income. And the difference here is that this works on a calendar year and you don't get that first 60 days. So only the contributions from January to December are tax deductible for that year. So don't think that you can contribute up till the end of February the following year and get a tax deduction for the previous year on like an RSP. So there is a difference in that sense.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I have a feeling there are going to be a lot of people thinking, okay, RSP and the FHSA are going to run concurrently, and there'll be like this big demand, and then they're going to find out, oh man, I missed it December 31st. And because, you know, you got that RSP season, and the fact they work like an RSP, they're going to maybe have that mentality. So yes, it's great to get that in. I know we set up a lot of them for our younger clients, again, with even $500 just to open the account before the year ended in 23.
Yeah, and I mean, it's an absolute great account, and for a lot of people that qualify for First Home Savings Account, so you do have to be a first-time home buyer or someone who hasn't lived or in a principal residence or had a principal residence for 4 years. So you can re-qualify as a first-time home buyer and actually qualify for this account if you didn't have one before. But once you've had one before and you've closed it, you can't open another one. So that is one interesting fact of this account. People, we're constantly learning about this account. There are lots of little things here. Just as I had a good question the other day, do I have to use the tax deductions for the next year? Well, you actually don't. So if you contributed $8,000 in 2023, you don't have to use that deduction for your 2023 income. As Don just mentioned, lots of these people are younger and they may not be making much money. Maybe they're making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, and it doesn't necessarily make sense to use a tax deduction because of their potential income down the road. Maybe they're going to make $100,000, maybe they're going to make $150,000. Save that tax deduction for future years, or use a bit of it. You don't have to use all of it. It's going to be there on your notice of assessment for future years so that you can use it. So that is one great aspect to the First Home Savings Account, is that you get the tax deduction and you don't have to pay this back. Unlike the RSP home buyers, you have to pay that back over 15 years.
Yeah. And you know what? It's kind of funny. That is the exact same rules in RSP. So if you have the RSP room, even if you had $100,000 of RSP room, you can throw in $100,000 into your RSP. You don't have to claim it. And this is the tricky thing when you're getting your income tax done. You do have to, especially we're in tax season right now, you have to explain this to their tax preparer, that you'd only want to use so much of it to get yourself to a certain level of income so that you're getting rid of, say, a 43% tax bracket or what have you, depending on the situation. But yeah, the same kind of planning needs to be done for this FHSA as for the RSP. And it's kind of like the tax bracket management that we've talked about many times on the show.
Yeah, exactly. Why cut back on a small tax when you can delay it and take it and get a bigger bang for your buck on that tax deduction? I know we go through lots of with our clients. We don't do their taxes, but we do give them advice on what tax bracket they really should be utilizing for this First Home Savings Account deduction or the RSP deduction, whichever one they're using. And just to make sure that they go to their accountant and this say, okay, well, this is what our financial planner said that we should be doing. just so they're getting a couple different opinions as to what they should be doing, and just to make sure that the best thing's being done for them. But now if we take a look at some spousal rules and strategies, that your spouse actually could affect your eligibility, because a first-time homebuyer is defined as someone who has not in the current or previous 4 calendar years lived in a principal residence owned in whole or in part by the individual or their spouse. So if you actually lived in a house with your spouse and you were common law and you didn't open a first home savings account before you started living with them or you're married with them, you can't open one. You don't qualify for it. And so you're going to be penalized if you do open that unknowingly. So you do have to make sure that you actually do qualify for this. Otherwise, you could be negatively affecting your financial well-being by opening this. Another thing here is there are no spousal first home savings account. So there are spousal RSPs, but there are no spousal first home savings account. Each individual who qualifies for their own first home savings account, just like a TFSA, there's no spousal TFSAs as well. So, but you can, on one hand, use your own money. So let's say you're the higher income earner and you wanted to put money into your spouse's first home savings account. You can do that with no attribution. So you're actually not going to have to pay tax on anything in that first home savings account if it was taken out not for a house. You're not going to have to pay for that. So that is one upside, one strategy, is that you can actually income split by depositing into your spouse's first home savings account. And one other here is you can use your spousal RSP dollars to contribute. So as I mentioned, there are spousal RSPs, and there's typically a 3-year rule that you can't take it out. With this first home savings account, it actually allows you to transfer from the spousal RSP into a first home savings account earlier than those 3 years, which is, it's just great. It allows the higher income earner to get that tax deduction, and then that can transfer into your spouse's first home savings account. And then it's in their name. It's already, the tax has already been taken care of because it's in a first home savings account now. And now you can put it towards a house if that's what you're going to use it for. And so that is a nice little strategy there that allows you to use those spousal RSP dollars instead of waiting those 3 years to do so. So that is one strategy there to add. So basically, the end of the day, the beauty is that the first home savings account removes one of the largest drawbacks of the homebuyer plan. So the RSP homebuyer plan has been around for a long time, and it removes the repayment or taxation of the withdrawal over the 15 years. You really don't have to have that burden of repaying that back and not getting a second tax deduction. So it's free RSP room, and you get to use it for a house. You get a larger amount than you would normally be able to put together there. So absolutely fully recommend this account.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. Call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. We're taking a break here. We're coming right back.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Planning is like a box of chocolates. Are we financial planning here or watching Forrest Gump?
I actually love that movie, Forrest Gump. What a great, and again, one of the most quotable parts of that movie was that life is like a box of chocolates.
You know, anyway, everyone tells me you look like Tom Hanks. Did you know that?
Well, no, that's great to know.
No, you know? See, I thought what you were going to say, Mitch, was he looks like Forrest Gump, but then you went with the actor. That's very smooth, Mitch, very smooth.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to be nice to him on this beautiful Saturday.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say that IG hit a home run in a recent ad. And I'm not a big advocate of a lot of the advertising I've seen in the past, say, 20 years, but this was outstanding. On Instagram, they had this 5x5 box of chocolates. So 25 different, really fancy looking chocolates. And they said, this is what an IG financial plan is. And it shows tax strategies, estate planning, mortgage and debt planning, investments, insurance planning, and retirement planning. And I would put in brackets cash flow management because they kind of go hand in hand. And then it shows, then it flips to the next screen. It says other financial plans. And it just shows one chocolate. And it says investments. And I just find it so powerful because really we come up across this all the time. And quite often we forget all the things that we do. And we do all these things on a day-by-day basis. I've kind of looked through this list of, you know, six different areas of a financial plan that we deal with. And I said, well, that's just a normal week for us. We've talked to clients about tax planning strategies. We talked to clients about estate planning. In this last week, mortgage planning and what should we look at doing and how much should we pay down and what's the best advantage? Is it tax deductible? There's so many things. Of course, investments is a very big part of it too, but it's just one of six. We've talked to clients about insurance planning and what type of insurance makes sense. Should it be term, whole life, et cetera? Is it for a business? And of course, retirement planning is all part of this living plan portal that Mitch and I have talked about many times over each show. That isn't happening. So if you are not getting proper planning, feel free to reach out, and because these are the areas that we will be discussing. So this kind of leads right into this latest kind of, I don't know if what you want to call it, but it's a very confusing CRA rule for reporting bare trusts. And this has come out in the papers, and it's actually been around for about a year. But all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, they're actually going to do this. So, you know, what is a bare trust? A bare trust is a way to hold property where one person appears on a legal document for the property, but a completely different person gets to enjoy the benefits and risks of owning the property, such as the income, paying expenses, or keeping the proceeds, or even living in it for that matter. So common situations. Let's say you co-signed a mortgage. And this is quite often with, you know, parents, grandparents. Mm-hmm. They're co-signing a mortgage. And they, being a co-signer, you're often obligated to take a 1% ownership on the deed. Well, no big deal, you thought, okay? But it turns out you now have to fill in this bare trust. You have to do a trust tax return. Another very common one is a joint bank account with elderly parents. And a lot of people do this. It's quite often you're helping to pay bills for your 90-year-old mother or father. And you didn't even think anything about this because it just makes sense. You might have to pay a couple bills a month. And that's about it. But now you have to fill in this bare trust tax return. And so now, by the way, if you don't, what are the penalties? Well, the penalties are $25 per day for a late return with a minimum of $100 and a maximum of $2,500. And when do you have to get this done by? Generally April the 1st. This year it's April the 2nd. So you got very little time now to get this done. It's not, most people feel you get it done April 30th. Trust tax returns have to be done at the beginning of April. Now, that being said, because there's mass confusion, in fact, in a Globe and Mail article back on Tuesday, CRA is now recognizing it could take 4 months to process the Canadian tax returns this year, where it's supposed to take just a few weeks because of all these T3s. I have no idea why they feel this is necessary. I'm sure there is a reason. I have a feeling they've cast this web out and they've caught a lot more in this web than they expected. And so all these kind of very innocent type of situations are all being grabbed. So what they're going to do this year is they're not going to penalize you this $25 a day. They're going to give you more time unless there was some gross negligence on this. But, there was a great article by Rob Carrick, again, in the Globe. And, you know, it was quite interesting. I read through the article. I'm going to go through a lot of this, actually, because it was a really great, you know, step-by-step way of getting this done. But the next thing is I I started reading through the comments. This just, it came out, and within hours, there was 60 comments on this. So you can see how emotional this is created. So, and some very smart people replied on this. So one of them was, you know, you left out the most important part, how to submit a Schedule 15. Unless one uses a tax preparer, and if you're a do-it-yourselfer, you have to print and mail the forms and the bear trust agreement to Winnipeg or Sudbury. This person reviewed the CRA website, called CRA how to submit it. The CRA agent was unsure, but did say one had to mail the complete form. And you can't do it on your My CRA account, which is beyond comprehensive, this person said. T3 reporting is poorly thought out and an executed policy. By the way, all the CRA agents I've spoken to in this have been extremely nice and friendly, patient and helpful. The next one, an excellent how-to piece, Rob, on getting this done. But if you have less than $50,000 in an account, you don't have to file. Okay. So that's one way. So if it's just a small account with your mother, father, and or your kids, whatever it is, you don't have to file it. These are the nice ones. There was some very emotional ones I read through this too, which were amusing. This one was kind of interesting. I'm just going to play dumb and pretend I didn't read anything in respect to parents and adults and joint accounts and so-called blind trust. Well, it was supposed to be bear trust. CRA can shove it. So that was kind of interesting. And that was, again, one of the nicer ones. Others are saying this is the most ridiculous thing we've ever had to do for CRA. This person here could actually do all their complex taxes for others and for themselves and others, but they have to ask how to fill this one in. And this was a real, in fact, they went to H&R Block in this case. They were unable to help at that location. Maybe others could. And they're asking accountants. Accountants are overwhelmed. They're not even returning phone calls on this. So you can only imagine that this is an absolute pain. So this was, they think it's a tax grab, but it really isn't. There's no tax that the person has to do. This is purely an information grab. This is so that CRA has more information. I guess there's some, again, the 1 in 1,000 are using the tax schemes to their benefit, and they want to catch those. But at the same time, they're catching the 999 that are just innocently doing things. So Rob Carrick, I got to give him credit. He put a really good, and if you go back to Tuesday, March 19th, and if you have an online account or just Google the how-to for people caught up in the CRA confusing new rules for reporting bear trusts, you can get a step-by-step. It is not easy. I'll put it that way, right out of the gate. It is not easy. And in his first comment, well, I never saw Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. It can't be scarier than the T3 trust income tax return. And if you have to file a trustee for a bear trust, that pretty much summed it up. It's very complex. It was probably for high net worth individuals and to manage the assets. And for bear trust, the T3 is an overkill. In this case, Rob is simply a joint account, owns a joint bank account for his 95-year-old mother. And he pays two bills per month. And he also makes a charitable donation on her behalf. So very straightforward.
I'm just going to jump in on this because I did have to go through this with one client. And I reached out to Advanced Financial Planning, part of IG Wealth, and they've now had to come up with basically a web, as in to step by step as to when you have to file one, when you don't, and every step from there. And it is very, very complex. So I'm just so interested in everything that you're saying right now, because it's almost like a lot of people don't understand it, and they don't make it easy to understand. And in this situation that I was going through, it was just they were sharing a bank account with their mother to help pay for expenses, just to be on it. So, and she wanted to make sure she didn't have to file one as well. So, brand new for this year that they have to start filing this. And I can tell from what you're saying right now, a lot of people are unhappy. So.
Oh, a lot of people are unhappy. So many people aren't unhappy because they don't know about it yet. Okay.
That's the blind trust part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And they've contacted their banks as per this article I was reading, and the banks don't know about it either. So this is where you really find out what your financial planner has been doing. Are they an investment planner or are they a real true financial planner? And this is why it's so important to work with somebody with their CFP, because tax planning is part of it. At least we're going to get down to the brass tacks. But it isn't simply, okay, I'll just fill in some form, no biggie. First thing you need to do is you need to get a trust account number. And most people have never thought of this because they never needed one. So in this particular case, he never considered getting a joint ownership with their mother's account is a trust arrangement. They didn't think of that. So now he needs to get a trust account number. They have to fill in this T3 APP application for trust account number. And the nice thing is that you can use the CRA's My Account portal that's available. So that was okay. And it does take some time to get your number. But you also have to provide a name of the account. Well, you can call in, this was actually kind of amusing. You could call it Fluffy or Rex after your dog, or you can use more of a, okay, my mother's trust account. You can just call it whatever you like, really. It's just a generic title. But you do need to put in things such as address, phone numbers, and such as for the name of the trustee, which means the person making the decisions, which would be in this case yourself if you are the one sending the checks. You also may add a fiscal period of, and most times it's easier simply to use the January 1st to December 31st. In fact, I would only use those because if you have an investments with the parent, then it's always reported on a calendar year. So then you have to, type the under what kind of trust code 7307, Bear Trust, simple enough. Okay, so you need to go follow through that. And you go through these individual steps. There's 14 questions you're asked, in which, in this case, the answer was no to all 14. Okay.
Oh my goodness.
So all these questions you have to be asking about this trust. Does it hold shares in a private corporation, et cetera, et cetera? And then you have to now calculate the trust total income. Now, this was interesting because it was a T5 because it was interest income. So they put zero. So even though you do not have to report any income because you're not actually getting any of this income, in this case, it was the mother getting the income, you still have to refill in all this paperwork because you do not want to have to pay the penalty. And it's also not only the 5% of the value of the trust. A minimum of $2,500 is a minimum fine and no limit. Okay. It's 5%. So if it's $1 million sitting in there, 5%, $50,000 fine. It doesn't make sense to go, you certainly don't want to miss that. So once you file through all this, there's a schedule 15 that this one comment was said, and you have to fill all that in. Again, quite complicated. So at the end of the day, you're doing a lot of work and it's an information grab, but you do need to do it. So for the listeners out there, get on this. I thought maybe, well, it certainly wouldn't apply to most situations. It turns out it does apply to almost every situation. And the other one, if you're a co-signer of a mortgage, you wouldn't even think anything about it because, again, you're not receiving any income. You're simply co-signed. Already it's bad enough that you co-signed the mortgage, okay, because you are liable for every mortgage payment. So you've already put yourself out there that if your daughter or son normally misses a mortgage payment, the bank can now go after you as a co-signer of that mortgage. So you've done your part, you felt you did anyway. Now you got to do this trust tax return on top of it. So it just doesn't stop. So this is definitely an information grab. Go through the process, painful as it is, and I would do it sooner than later. The good news is you won't get penalized because I don't believe there are the cases. We're just hearing about it actually in the papers now. So most people do not even know about this yet. So kind of trust, buyer beware, get her done. And go check out your box of chocolates to make sure that your financial planner has a tax planning part to your plan.
We are planning your financial future and your box of chocolates. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. A quick break here. We're coming back.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. Find out more at donfox.net. Call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. FOMO and the irrational investor. Where do we go here?
Yeah, so these are two things that they often go hand in hand with investors, and it very usually for them is driven by emotions. And when you're doing anything with the height of emotions, it's usually not going to work out very well. And I'm currently looking at a photo here that says at the top of it, greed, and people buy, and then when everyone's scared, they sell and they repeat until they're broke. And that's pretty much the emotional cycle there of investing and doing the opposite of what you should be doing. And today I'm going to take a look at a pretty hot topic here as it's been performing very well. I'm going to talk about Bitcoin today. So let's start with some information on Bitcoin. First of all, what is it? Bitcoin is a form of cryptocurrency, a virtual currency designed to act as money, as a form of payment outside the control of any person, entity, or third party. So basically, you can transact moving any amount of funds to someone else without having to go through the bank, which can have its benefits for sure. I know lots of large transactions do have to have holds at the bank, could be for weeks. So there is a pretty good use case here, but let's go back all the way to 2009 when Bitcoin started. On January 3rd, 2009, the first Bitcoin block was mined. And so the way that it works is this currency is mined and these miners are continuously doing mathematical problems to mine this Bitcoin. And roughly every 4 years, the amount of Bitcoin that can be mined is halved. So in 2009, you can get 50 new Bitcoins for every time you mined. And then all the way in 2020, because it's been halved a few times, you can get 6.25. And now the next one is supposed to happen basically in a month, in April 2024. And you'll now be able to get 3.125 Bitcoins for the mining. So every 4 years it gets reduced in halves. And so this year is a big year for Bitcoin. There's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoin in existence. So this plus having a supply that's never going to increase and the demand that's either staying the same or over the years it's been increasing is why Bitcoin price continues to go up. And the first notable transaction involving Bitcoin was actually in May 22nd, 2010, by exchanging 10,000 Bitcoins for two pizzas. And that 10,000 Bitcoin today would be worth roughly $700 million.
Wow.
So
how good was that pizza?
A pretty expensive. Yeah, probably not that good, but it provided a use case for Bitcoin, and ever since then, it has gained traction. But I'm sure that guy wish he still had those 10,000 Bitcoin
no
at this
kidding.
Point. recently, about a few weeks ago, Bitcoin finally got the SEC in the U.S. to approve many ETFs, and one of them was being BlackRock's. And it crossed a big number, 10 billion assets under management in just over 7 weeks. And inflation adjusted, the gold ETF took 2 years to achieve this. So it is growing exponentially how quickly this is going. And a lot of people are saying Bitcoin is digital gold. You can hold it yourself, you can manage it yourself, and you get to do it on your own versus having these huge lumps of gold. Why would anyone want to have these huge lumps of gold when you can just have a hard drive with your digital gold on it? So it's a lot less clunky. It doesn't take up as much space. So there are now many ETFs in the US, and so far they've exceeded about $500 billion across these 9 ETFs in just a short amount of time. So now with this information, what should you be doing? First thing you need to ask yourself if you were ever thinking about getting into Bitcoin is why? Why do you want to invest in Bitcoin? If it is to get rich, that ship has likely sailed. I can't predict the future, but if you're thinking about you can put $500 in there and get rich, that's not going to happen. You're talking about something that went from 1 cent in 2009 all the way to $74,000. So to say that you're still early cannot be true. Yes, it can still go up from here, but to get that massive return, you're likely not going to get that one anymore. And this won't come with a lack of volatility either. You're talking about every 4 years, it's gone up a ton and then down a lot. So you're talking 1 year, it went from 1 cent to 1,000, then it went down to 100, then it went up to 17,000, then it went down to 1,000. So it's gone up a lot, and then it'll drop about 80%, 80 to 90%. This most recent downturn over the last few years, it went down about 70 to 75%. And so you do have to have a stomach for that volatility as well. So not only are you not going to get rich by putting $500 into this Bitcoin, you're also going to add more stress to your life. So you're not going to get those insane returns anymore. And do your goals even need you to take on such a risk? If we're getting people in their retirement years that we've done all of their planning for, asking if they should be putting money into Bitcoin, well, do you really need to? Do you need to get that added return? How's it going to increase your plan? Well, what's it going to do for you? Because if you need that added bit of return, you shouldn't need that during retirement. We've planned you out to have a certain rate of return based off of your risk levels that's going to achieve all of your goals that you've laid out for us. Why do we need to add a more volatile asset for you to maybe have more money down the line? Do you even need the more money down the line? Some people say they have no estate, so well, I don't care. I'll gamble this money and see where it goes. And I mean, that's fine to do that, but make sure that if that money goes to zero, you're not going to affect your retirement plan at all. So make sure it's gambling play money on the side, maybe a small percentage, 1 to 2% of your portfolio, and that's about it. Okay. And last thing here is don't use a TFSA for it, because if you lose your Bitcoin, if it goes to zero, you're going to lose that TFSA room for good.
We are planning our financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Quick break here. Our final segment coming up.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. Find out more at donfox.net. Call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Improving your investment success. How do we do that?
Well, you know, it really depends on what age you're at. And this is where you need to have a custom plan for yourself. And again, there's, you know, basically three different stages. You could probably make sub stages if you like, but again, it starts off young, and procrastination is the biggest enemy. So right off the get-go, accumulating stage is that first type of investor. And those are young people. You know, they're out of university or college or got their first job, and they just have to put money somewhere. And, you know, things such as the FHSA that Mitch talked about earlier, it really doesn't matter. You know, some people are saying, well, let's put it in an RSP. It's not a terrible idea at that age, only because even if they're not in a high tax bracket, because it's all about trying to put some money together. It's not about saving tax. It's about discipline and creating a habit, and ideally doing it monthly. And that's the best way to do it. Now, the FHSA is even a better strategy than an RSP, because you're basically not using the RSP room. And Mitch went all through that in the earlier segment. So it's you're young. It's a simple stage. You got time on your side. In fact, volatility is on your side. If you're adding monthly, you're now buying more shares. It's called dollar cost averaging. When the shares drop in price, you end up buying more shares because you're, let's say you're adding $300 a month and the shares were $10 a share. Well, you just bought 30, in case of mutual funds, units, 30 shares each month. Well, now the price dropped to $5. Well, now you just bought 60. So you're buying automatically. You don't have to time the market. The fact you're adding monthly will do it for you. So it takes all the timing out. Dollar cost averaging is magic. So you end up through dollar cost averaging with a below average cost because you buy more shares when they're cheap and less shares when they're expensive because you add the same amount every month. Equities are definitely your best friend too. As we mentioned, you like the volatility. If you're in a very safe investment, you will not, there's the dollar cost averaging whole scenario does not work for you. And really, equities, even though they do have more volatility, the returns are far greater. And a difference of a couple percent is massive over 30, 40 years. So some people say, well, I can't afford to invest that long term. Well, it's kind of funny. If you were part of a pension fund, for example, a teacher or what have you, it comes off your pay. You have no choice. Well, I guess you have a choice. You don't have to be a teacher, okay? So it comes off your pay. And they're taking off 13% off your pay and putting it away. So that is the kind of mentality you need to save long term. You have to pay yourself first. So that is really the whole idea. And then you want to look at the investment spectrum. If you're going to do it, invest what kind of geography, not just in Canada, US, Europe, emerging markets, maybe even 1% to 2% Bitcoin, as Mitch was just talking about. So, you know, against volatility is on your side again, and you got to be very prudent still on how you do it. And again, talk to a financial planner what the best mix is. Now, you also look at what type is it, growth style or value styled? So that's different types of investment styles. And large companies or small companies, large cap versus small cap, as they call it. So then you go a little later in the career, called it late career stage. And now you really look at what is your goal? Okay, you still want to participate in those strong markets, but you don't probably want to go through those negative ones. Well, nobody really does. But you've got a little less time on your side because you see this end date, retirement. Well, I like to move that goalpost to death date, not retirement. Reason is most people spend a good third of their life in retirement. And yet we kind of look at, okay, I'm investing and I got this date. Well, what happens after that date? You still want to beat inflation. You still want to have good investment returns. So yes, you may want to add some fixed income to your mix for sure. Okay, maybe 20, depending if you have a pension fund. If you already have a pension at work, a defined benefit plan, then you can definitely be more aggressive with your other investments because you've got this kind of big GIC, big guaranteed investment certificate called a pension. So therefore, you can be more aggressive. Now, if you do not have a pension fund, which most don't these days, then you want to say, okay, maybe 30% fixed income, 70% equity. Create this mix. And don't make the mistake of extrapolating the returns. Because a lot of people will look at the past. Oh, look what this has done. Oh, it should continue on this path. That's exactly the way it doesn't work. Okay. It never works that way. And it always will do a zig when you think it's going to do a zag. So you want to make sure you're not extrapolating returns. And volatility is still your friend because now you get to rebalance every so often. You got this pot of money. And if there's a downside in the stock market, you move money from fixed income to buy more equities and vice versa. Move money from equities when they've done well to fixed income to rebalance. And that will actually help your returns. And finally, there's the retirement stage. This is actually the most difficult part to invest. You still need a steady income. You still need good returns. And you probably got 30 years of inflation protection you need or longevity risk. Canada Pension Plan and Old Age Security Planning, extremely important. We've talked about that. Income splitting and tax planning, extremely important. And sequence of returns is also important. And this is where the Monte Carlo analysis comes into play, where when the market drops, where before you're adding during a down market, now you're taking money out. So it works to your disadvantage now. So again, you really need to have a planner, a financial planner that will go through each stage and decide what is the best strategy for you. And that's where, you know, dealing with a CFP or somebody with a CFP makes a big difference.
We have been planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox have been here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Another fabulous show, gentlemen. Thanks so much for the time and have a great week.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900 CHML.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.